Now we begin by reading Ecclesiastes chapter 1 to keep in mind that what we are studying tonight may appear nothing to do with scriptures, but actually we just want to set the background to realize that knowledge has to be acquired by a man of God. In the case of Solomon, he was a man of God and he acquired much knowledge, but he knew that all this knowledge, while they are needful and helpful to some extent, there is nothing compared to knowing God's word and knowing God himself. So that sets the background for us. We don't want to chase it away and then treat the knowledge of the world as though they are unimportant. We don't want to know. We just want to know the Bible. Now that is unrealistic living. And other passages may be harnessed or called upon to help us see that there is a proper place for Christians to acquire knowledge and produce knowledge to help people in the world, because God created the world, everything good, and it was spoiled by sin. But still, the mandate to mankind remains: be fruitful and multiply and subdue the earth. You see, so to subdue the earth means that we have to study and do research and be involved in scientific discovery and be productive in producing the wholesome songs and poetry and be those who are able to write and to be involved in the accumulation and the spreading of knowledge that are helpful. See, so anything right and good has been abused. So knowledge has been abused, and God's gifts have been abused. But Christians don't withdraw and retreat, but we believe in engaging the world. So we don't retreat. So don't overprotect your children. Don't tell them this, you can't do that, you can't do. No. Instead, teach them biblical values, strengthen them and send them forth so that they may be salt of the earth and light of the world. If we keep withdrawing and say to our children, this cannot do, that cannot do, you know, you send them to Christian school because you don't want to be influenced by the wrong teaching in public schools and you want to live in a secluded place where you have less influence of the world. So you keep protecting your children and you keep running away, then you will not make them strong, you see. So we prefer rather to engage the world. We don't have to fear the world. The Lord is on our side. There's always the danger that we might be influenced and be drawn away, of course. But it is far better to do that than to withdraw, you see? And the teaching of the Bible would be that we engage the world. We are in the world. We don't withdraw and isolate ourselves. So we are in the world but not of the world. And that is an important part. So we want to strengthen ourselves, strengthen our children in the Bible's teaching, and then send them forth to face the world, you see? So if we are the type who are so pietistic all the time, keeping ourselves pure, you discover you'll never be pure also, see? Then you also lose out on the opportunity of being useful. So in the current series, we are considering the Christian in the Chinese culture. And we say that many of the Christians in this country have to face problems living in the Chinese culture. And the principles of scripture applied to living in the Christian culture may be applied to other cultures as well. So you see how it is done. So for myself, personally, I don't have experience in other cultures much, see? So it will require a person from that culture to be able to understand your own culture best. So for myself, I would only speak from what I'm experienced with, I've been exposed to. So then you see how the scripture is applied, and then how we analyze the culture that we are in, and then try to live well before God. Okay? So we arrive at the point where we come to consider Chinese philosophy. And at first I thought of not doing this because it might appear somewhat academic and dry to some people. But then I realized that to others it's not dry, it is interesting. And it helps summarize the things that you will take time to, you need to find time to explore, you see. So therefore you discover that there is value in considering this subject. Then this underlines what we are going to learn concerning the how it, the culture and philosophy affects the life of the typical Chinese, you see. And some are more typical than others, you see. So we have to note that this is not mere academic studies. It is in order that we may understand what we are faced with. If you are a Chinese who is converted, you have to understand why the Chinese culture is such and why your parents behave in a certain way. And if you are witnessing to a Chinese person, you discover he thinks in a certain way, behaves in a certain way. See, sometimes, for example, he may say, "Oh no, don't eat that too much," so or don't drink that too much, you know, because it's what, it's too cooling. So what is meant by cooling? See, the drink may be warm, and he say it's too cooling. See, or you know, don't eat durian too much; it is too heaty for you. You say, what does it mean by heaty and cooling? See? All this arise from a certain philosophy, see, and it affects the way the Chinese behave and think. See? So we take it for granted because we hear this and along the way, this is just typical Chinese. But if you want to bear good witness to them, or you want to live well and interact with them and adjust to the Chinese culture, then you have to understand all this. And the more you understand, of course, the better and more effective you will be in integrating with the Chinese people and in witnessing to them. Yeah? So here it is with this purpose that we consider this subject of Chinese philosophy. And we begin by noting that our interest here is not with the so-called fine arts such as painting, dance, music and poetry. Rather, our concern is with those branches of studies and skills that have developed within the Chinese culture, including martial arts. So is it right for the Christian to be involved or to practice martial arts? Qigong, is it right to practice those? You see, it's supposed to be for health. You see, breathing exercise and movement, so what's wrong with that? So, but some people say it's wrong. So others say it's okay. See, so how do we go about dealing with issues like this? Then Chinese medical practice, TCM is quite well established in some countries. In other countries, they look upon it as superstition, and you don't want anything to do with it. See, for example, New Zealand just passed the law that TCM is banned in the country. Nobody should practice TCM. See, you go and go to consult the Chinese things at your own risk. They just sweep aside that. But on the other hand, you see, there are those who go to China to learn acupuncture, and then they are now performing some operations without anesthesia. See, they just put acupuncture needles at certain points, and then you can perform certain surgical procedures. So how come it works? You see, the person is conscious, but he doesn't feel any pain, just because some needles are placed in certain points in the body. You see? So Western science still haven't understood this fully. Yeah. So on the one hand, there are the scientific, what appear to be something that has scientific basis, but on the other hand, there seems to be a lot of hocus pocus. So how do we separate them? You know, how do we look at the Chinese traditional medicine as a whole? Then we hear so much of feng shui. What is that? Is there any value in that? And to what extent can we believe in this? See? So what is feng shui? You know, and even if we don't practice it, we meet with people who seem to believe in feng shui. So one day you or your son, you know, or your daughter trained as an architect, then he works in a company, and then the big company, a big client, millions of dollars. Your company gets the project, and you're assigned to design that their building, you see. Then the company, your client, keep mentioning feng shui, right feng shui, wrong feng shui, and how, which direction it must face, and on what elevation, and so on. See, you don't chase away all this. You wouldn't be a good worker in your company. You can't help the client. You know, your client might be angry at you for not listening to him. You see, so then you will be foolish of you. Yeah. So, but if you understand a little of feng shui, and then don't fear it, and don't be so absorbed with it, but you say that you have a correct view and correct approach to this subject, at least it will help you in your career or in when you meet with people who are so much in feng shui, okay? So we know that underlying this arts is the system of thought which encompasses the principles of yin and yang, and also the principle of the five elements and the principle of Bát Quái. So these principles are distinct but interrelated. They have been applied separately or in conjunction with one another. So sometimes applying one set of principles require that you draw in another set of principles. At other times you can just apply it by itself. Okay? So this is just a very, very basic introduction to these subjects. So here we cover the philosophy behind the many beliefs and actions of the Chinese, including the applications which we will look at, God willing, in the next study, and followed by an assessment of the whole subject from a Christian perspective. So tonight we cover or learn, try to learn what is Chinese philosophy. Next week, God willing, we'll consider the applications of those philosophy, that philosophy, and then finally we'll consider the Christian perspective to Chinese philosophy and its applications. And by philosophy here, we are not using it in the broad sense as is normally done. And here when we talk about Chinese philosophy, we are not referring to the teaching of Chinese philosophers like Confucius, like Lao Tzu, or like Mencius, Mencius, okay? So we are not talking about that. We are not referring to that. We are not going to study their philosophy, see? But rather we are studying the philosophy behind the arts that are practiced by the Chinese so that in everyday life we meet with them and we encounter these arts, then we know a little bit of the background behind these arts. Okay, this is what we mean. So there are these three areas: the yin yang principle, the five elements or wu xing, the form, five forms, then the pa gua or eight trigrams. So pa means eight, gua is a trigram. So we consider the yin yang principle. Now, ancient Chinese philosophers called the void and boundless state which prevailed before the world was created as wu qi. So wu is nothing, nothingness. Wu qi is, can be translated as ultimate nothingness. See? Then from this state of wu qi was formed the universe. Then wu qi may be thought of as a condition as well as a thing. It had form, yet was unformed. It had shape, yet without shape. You may think that we are talking in riddles, but don't, I guess, as I say at the beginning, don't chase it away, don't treat it as trivial. We try to understand what they are saying so that we, they have good reasons for believing what they believe. So how valid or to what extent they are valid, that will be assessed later. But for the moment, let us respect this ancient culture and what has been handed down all these centuries, you see. So this phenomenon of nothingness was the source of movement and stillness. So you see the opposite movement, then there's stillness. So the movement and stillness arises from wu qi. The state of wu qi was regarded as being made up of the yin element. Within the yin was the germ of the yang element. So what are yin and yang? Yeah, we will be clear as we go along. When the yang element began to manifest itself, the state of wu qi or nothingness no longer existed. It is at that point that the state of tai qi began. We often hear the word tai qi in relation to the martial arts, which is widely practiced as a form of health or exercises today. But originally it was actually a very high form of martial arts, and today some people still practice it as a martial arts, and it is regarded as a very high art because it's slow to cultivate but its power is very great. The techniques are amazing, see? And it is based on the principle of Tai Chi. That's why it's called Tai Chi Qian. Qian is martial art. Qian, big, thick, literally means fist. So So when you fight, you basically use the fist. So any fighting art is called Qian, Tai Chi Qian. Yeah? So it's the fighting art based on the philosophy of Tai Chi. Okay? So what is Tai Chi? Basically involves the yin-yang principles. Okay? So Tai Chi may be translated the great ultimate or the grand terminus. Yin and yang began to interact with one another in a complementary way. So this is beginning from Wu Qi, then we moves on to Tai Chi. Okay? So Tai Chi, in Tai Chi, the yin and yang is interacting together. Mm-hmm. Although they are opposite in nature, there is a harmonious relationship between them. As the yang element increases, the yin element decreases, and vice versa. And just as the yin element contains the germ of the yang element also contains the yin element. The evolution of the Tai Chi from Wu Qi may be represented by the diagram where there is a circle that's blank, see? And even a solid circle wouldn't represent it, it's represented by a broken circle. So that is the broken circle represents Wu Qi, nothingness. It has form and yet it's formless, it's not formed, you see. It has shape and yet without shape, you see. How do you define it? It's there but it's not there. You see, you touch it, it's not there, it's there, you see. It's, you don't regard it as nothingness, but it is there. Something is there, but we don't know what it is. So that is Wu Qi. Then when things begin to stir, then we have the beginning of Tai Chi, when the germ of Tai Chi is in the broken circle. Okay? So we put a dot as a, to indicate that the yang principle is begin to, the yin principle, the stirring is the yang, the dot represents the yin. So the yin, while the yang is stirring, the yin is still is there. So finally we have Tai Chi. Tai Chi is represented by the diagram of a circle with a curvy line through the center. Okay? So there are two halves and they look like two fish chasing after one another. There is a white fish and a black fish. And in the black fish is a white dot like the eye of the fish. And in the white fish there is a black dot like the eye of the fish. So basically it's representing the curvy line separating the two represents dynamic action, there's movement, it's not still. See? And you note that the diagram represents well the concept that as the white grows more, become more prominent, the black grows less, it has to. And as the black grows more, the white has to grow less. See? And within the black is the germ of the white. In the white, there is the germ of the black. In other words, you can't totally eliminate yin and yang. When yang comes to nothing, yin will be full. When yin comes to nothing, yang will be full. So it is like, if you like, a balloon filled with water, you see. So you squeeze one part, the water goes to another part, it bulges the other side. You squeeze another part, it bulges the other side. You can't really get rid of the water, short of bursting the balloon and you don't have the model anymore. See? So here you see that the representation helps us to visualize the basic concept of the yin and yang and how they interact with one another and how they began. See? Then the Wu Qi and Tai Chi concepts describe not only aspects of the creation of the universe, but also stages of all relationships between people, between objects, and between people and objects. So people and people, objects and objects, people and objects. The interaction may be explained or fitted to a model in which the yin and yang elements interplay. For example, a room before people enter it is in the Wu Qi state. When people go into the room, they bring movements and Tai Chi begins. You get the idea? Yeah? It's a bit philosophical, but I think it's not too difficult to understand. An empty room is wu ji, there's nothingness. See, to say there's nothingness yet, there is a potential for something there. See, when people enter, then you discover it's being occupied and activity is there. Since there's activity now, it's tai ji, it's no more wu ji. So wu ji has turned to tai ji, and as tai ji begins, wu ji reduces. And the more tai chi there is, the more wu chi reduces. You see? So wu chi gives rise to tai chi. And yet, tai chi and wu chi, as it were, are interrelated. Tai chi arose from wu chi. Right? Similarly, the relationship between a person and a piano is wu chi, if the person has no intention to play it. As soon as the intention arises in him to play the piano, tai chi has begun. It has begun. But to what extent? It is only when you put your fingers there, you begin to play, tai chi is growing. See? Wu chi is reducing. See? Then you take note of the diagram again. The tai chi diagram consists of a double fish of different polarity. It illustrates how the two opposites can be harmonized into a whole interrelated unit. For example, where there is day, there must be night. And where there is night, there must be day. Day is yang, and night is yin. Similarly, the sky is yang, and the earth is yin. Then man is yang, and woman is yin. Heat and motion are yang, while cold and stillness are yin. And then in the interaction with one another, the husband is yang, and he needs the wife who is yin to produce the cooperation that is needed in a harmonious family. And this is adopted and applied much in Taoism. We have learned that the Chinese religion consists of three major influences: Buddhism, Taoism, and Confucianism. So Buddhism talks about life after death, whereas Confucianism has nothing to say about life after death. See? So Buddhism talk about reincarnation and so on. Confucianism didn't have anything to say except reverencing our elders, and that got extended to reverencing the dead. Otherwise, there's nothing much to say about life after death. His concern is with this world, and then it wants an ordered society. So harmony, unity, and that begins from the top, working its way down to the bottom. See? Whereas Taoism works its way down from the bottom to the top. See? And Taoism also tries to achieve unity. Huh? And by living in harmony, one with another and with the environment. See? And this is where the Tai Chi principles play a great part, especially in Taoism. We say Taoism has contributed to the spiritist and mystical aspect of the Chinese religion. So spirits, good and bad. See? And you see, the Taoist monk performing his rituals in order to cast out demons or to call upon the spirits to help and so on. See? So the Tai Chi principles is involved. Okay. So much for the yin and yang principle. There's no need for us to delve too much. For the moment, it's sufficient. Then, when God willing, we come to the applications of these principles. Later in everyday life, you will begin to see how to the Chinese it makes sense, you see. Then we come to the next principle, the five elements or wu xing. According to Chinese philosophy, the five elements, water, fire, wood, metal and earth, are not inactive matter, but dynamic processes which are basic to an understanding of the natural world. And normally, in English, we translate wu xing as the five elements, when in fact the word wu is five, but xing is more than just elements. Xing also conveys a certain dynamism there, which is not translated which is not carried over by the word elements. You say elements is a thing, but when we say wu xing, we are talking about not only the thing, but its form, its existence, how it came about, you see. So you see, discover different languages, they use words differently, and you have to find something that conveys this other concept that is involved. It's not just a thing, but it also has a certain dynamism about it, you see. Then, how are they related? Yeah. Now, in Chinese, of course, we depending on what sort of family background you are brought up in, and whether you go to Chinese school or non-Chinese school, and whether you are Chinese-minded or not, to what extent you are Chinese-minded, the people you interact, all this come into play. But you discover a person who is very Chinese in every way may not be interested in this sort of thing. So in their life, they might not know all this at all. So for example, the Chinese zodiac, say, in our type of family background, we can say we are quite traditional. So from young, we were taught to count in our dialect. That's why up to today, when basic counting, I still use my dialect because it began from young, you know. So I still say, check nosa sing, ola check pe kao zang. And so from young, we were taught the Chinese calendar, the zodiac animals. So we have to recite, ik chi ji gu sang ho si to ngô leng lao chua chek bè po yin yang kao kao zap kwe zap e bè zap ji tu. See? Ik chi ji gu sang ho si to ngô leng lao chua. It's a ik chi, one red. Ik chi ji gu, ji is two. The ox or the cow, two cow. Sa ho, three tiger. Sa ho si to ngô leng lạp chua. So the rabbit, dragon, the horse. So each animal is assigned to a certain year. So there's a 12 year cycle. Okay? And in a Chinese psyche, if you talk to the older neighbors or what, you say, they might ask you, you say, what year are you born in? Then you say, year of the horse. Straight away in her mind, oh, you are 2 years younger than me. She might be able to work out very quickly, because in the mind, she has worked out the 12-year cycle. So she is perhaps a horse as well. So when I mention that I'm born in the year of the horse, she has worked out that I'm younger than her. So how much younger? Perhaps, you say, now she, it made 2 years, she say, roughly the same age, same generation. So you say, my like bear, rolling like bear. So he work it out. So she is 2 years earlier than me, see? So actually, who go saho si to rolling like so, take bear, see? So he works out, he says, oh, you are there. So I am here. So so I'm dragon, you are horse. So we are of the same generation. So you are 2 years younger than me. See? And in their mind, they are so used to it that it's very quick. Okay? And I told you that you go to a Chinese herbal shop, you see the whole wall is full of those drawers where they keep the herbs. See? There's so many of them. You see? So how do they remember, what herb is where and what herb is where? So when you bring a prescription, the Chinese thing says, write the prescription, you bring it to the herbal shop. See? They look at it, say, this item, you go to that drawer, take out some and weigh how much. The next item, he goes another drawer, takes some and then weigh it. You see? This combination is to be brought home to brew in him. The person might say, here, your Chinese thing says, say, three bowls of water boiled to one. So you have to put into that special earthenware, pour three bowls of water in, and you boil until roughly, it is one bowl. Then that is the right concentration. Then you will let it cool down and drink. But what amazed me is, how did they know which drawer contains what? They have already classified their medicine into different categories. Some are from animal parts, some are from tree parts, some are from insects and so on, some are from roots and so on. They classify broad categories, and then broad categories they subclassify. See? Then they, in their memory, the one is referred to, is related to the rat. So anything that's one in their mind, they use the animal to remember. See? So then two is related to the ox. So the number two column is somehow in his mind is ox. So it's a memory aid to them. Yeah. So that's why they are so fast. They're so fast they can quickly go to what row of drawer, which number drawer to extract the herb that you need for your prescription. Okay. So these are some of the applications. Then the Wu Xing, yeah, I recited it in Hokkien because my Kung Fu teacher was a Hokkien, so she used a Xiamen. That is, we had learned the philosophy behind the martial arts. We say, you know, Kim Bok Swing Or Tor. Kim is gold, Bok is wood, Sui is water, Ngo is fire, Tor is wood. So it's a poetic way of using words, because normally we say kim, we don't say bok, we say cha or bak, but the poetic way is bok. You see, it's according to the usage. So for example, today if you want to ask people his phone number, you say 2102 something like that. You see, why do they say Jiyo Kong Jiyo? What is Jiyo? Yo is one, because they don't want to confuse it and chit, you know, so it sounds similar. So they say Yo instead of chit. You say, but it is only used when you are asking for numbers, a string of numbers, though they will recite as Yo. But if you are not used to it, why, you know, Yo or Yao, you know, in Mandarin you say Yao, you know. Why they, isn't it Yi? Why you say Er Yao Ling Yao? They don't want you to confuse Yi and Qi, you know, difficult. You know, it sounds so similar. So when you talk fast or you talk too softly or through the phone, there's some disturbance, you can't catch what is said, you get confused. So in this area, the words are slightly pronounced slightly differently, but we know what it means. So we say Kim Bok Swing Or Tor. Kim is gold, Bok is wood, Sui is water, Ngo is fire, and then the earth, Tor is Tu, Ni Tu, the Tu. So Tor, normally we say Tor, we don't say Tor, but because it is used in that context, it is pronounced that way for a certain purpose, so that there's a certain rhythm about it, Kim Bok Swing Or Tor. Yeah. Now, back to the notes, you note that water, how they relate to one another. Water has the properties of soaking and descending or flowing down. Fire both heats. Let's look at number one first. According to Chinese philosophy, the five elements, water, fire, wood, metal, and earth, are not inactive, but dynamic processes which are basic to an understanding of the natural world. Now, see their relationship. Water has the properties of soaking and descending and flowing down. Fire both heats and moves upwards, seems flames rise into the air. Metal can be melted and molded and then hardened. Earth provides nourishment through plants can be used to build bumps. Then these five elements are used to represent different phenomena and dynamic processes. So understood that way, the elements are not static, just not by itself. When we talk about water, we talk of movement, its flow, and generally downwards. When we talk about fire, it's burning things up, the flames are rising up. So we're not talking about the thing as though it is just a static object, but there's movement and it is doing something. So if these five elements relate to one another, see? Well, out of these five elements, four principles are developed based on their interrelations. The first is mutual creation, second is mutual closeness, third is mutual destruction, and third is mutual fear. Okay? According to the principle of mutual creation, the five elements produce each other. Wood creates fire, fire creates earth, earth creates metal, metal creates water, that is, it liquefies. Huh? So you must look at the concept, you see. So when fire melts metal, metal becomes water. Yeah? See, a liquid form, is so it's like water. So water creates wood, see? Because water allows the seed to grow and then it soon becomes a tree. So wood is produced, you see. Okay, huh? So you see the concept. Don't limit it to just the mere object, but see it as in a category that interacts with others. The same pairs of elements are related to each other by the principle of mutual closeness. Each element is considered attracted to its source. So wood is close to water. Earlier we say water gives rise to wood, see, because from water the plant grows, you see? So now wood is close to water, water to metal. See, earlier we said the fire melts the metal, then metal becomes water. Huh? In liquid form, liquid metal is like water. So water is attracted to metal, metal to earth, and earth to fire, and fire to wood. Then the principle of mutual destruction describes the series of conflicts between pairs of elements. Wood weakens earth by removing nutrients from the soil. Earth, which gives rise to the wood, when wood comes to earth, it is actually depriving of the nutrients from the soil. Then earth limits water to lakes and seas and by man-made dams. Yeah? So when water is flowing everywhere, so how do you limit the flow of water? Create a dam, quickly get the mud and then build a dam to prevent the water flowing everywhere. Then you can contain the water, you see. Then water extinguishes fire, and fire conquers metal by melting it. Metal in the form of axes and knives can cut down trees and carve wood. So this is a mutual destruction. So metal is able to attack wood. Yeah. Then the converse principle, mutual fear. An element respects or fears the element which could destroy it. Wood fears metal. Earlier we said metal can destroy wood, so wood therefore fears metal. Yeah, so there is a certain holding back when metal comes near. See, so wood and metal meet, wood would have to hold back a little. See, then metal fears fire, yeah? Because earlier fire melts the metal, so metal when faced with fire is fearful. See, and fire fears water because water will put out the fire. See. Then water fears the earth because the earth will limit it in its flow. Okay? And earth fears wood because once the tree grows, the root grows into the wood, the earth, it penetrates the earth and sucks out all its nutrient. Okay? So that appears somewhat simplistic, but it is put into four categories of relationship like that. And in that way, combined with the other principles, it helps the Chinese philosophers to work out the interaction of people and people, people and objects, objects and objects, you see. So here there are the five elements with the four relationships that are possible: mutual creation, mutual closeness, mutual destruction, mutual fear. Then we come to the Pakua, or eight trigrams. In the principle of Tai Chi, the yang element is often represented by a line, a solid line, or by a small white circle. The yin is usually represented by two broken line segments or by a small black circle. So in the first section, when we considered how Tai Chi began from Wu Qi, you see the diagram of the Tai Chi. There, the white represents yang and the black represents yin. But in the white, there is a black dot. In the black, there is a white dot. So the yang is represented by a white circle, the yin by small black circle. But the yang can be represented by a solid line as well, and the yin represented by a broken line. By combining these two symbols, we get a total of four combinations of forms. If you look at the diagram there, see, then you discover solid lines represent yang, a broken line represents yin. By combining the solid line with a solid line, you get one possible combination. With combining the broken line and a broken line, you get another combination. In between, you can have a solid line at the top and the broken line at the bottom. That is called the lesser yang. The yang predominates, so you refer to the yang, but it's not as strong as the double solid line, the great yang. See? Because below it, it's not a yang, but it's a yin, therefore it's a lesser yang. It's not a lesser yin because we refer to the one that is at the top, it's a yang, okay? But it's lesser. Then similarly, the broken line at the top with a solid line at the bottom, that is the lesser yin, because the yin is at the top, so we refer to that symbol as the yin symbol, but it is lesser yin, as in contrast to the great yin, which is made up of two broken lines. Eh? Then by extending the number of lines to three in each form, we get a total of eight different combinations, each with its own name. And I wouldn't go into the names of the different combinations. See? And these are the basis of the Bakwa, or eight trigrams. So instead of two lines, you now combine it into three. You have three lines, so now you have eight possibilities. The first mythical emperor of Chinese history, Fu Xi, in 2900 BC, so in other words, 2900 BC, around about that time. He is credited as the inventor of the Bakwa. Fu Xi's circular arrangement of the eight trigram is called the Fu Xi or Xian Tian Bakwa. Xian Tian, Xian is earlier, Tian is heaven or sky. So the earlier heaven, Bakwa. Yeah? This was supposed to be drawn up by this very early in character called Fu Xi. Fu Xi is supposed to be the one who taught the Chinese people how to fish, how to make nets, and how to plant. And together with his wife, some refer to as a sister, you see. Nuwa is the female figure who was supposed to be the first mother of all the people. So in some ways, it must be related to the biblical account of Adam and Eve. But the Chinese mythology stretches to those early days when things were not written down yet. Fu Xi is also the one who is supposed to begin that ideogram, the Chinese characters, the Chinese writing alphabets, okay? He was the one who began with the so-called grass characters, the early form of the present Chinese writings. And the story basically goes this way, that he's normally represented as an individual with a human top and a dragon bottom, you see. And somehow he has a sister called Nuwa. Nuwa was supposed to be, they have desires for one another, but because she was his sister, he restrained himself. So they went to a mountain. They are supposed to be from the Kunlun Mountains in the north Shaanxi province there, the Kunlun Mountains, you see. And they went to call upon the heavens to show that if they were to get married, let the mist settle on them. If they were not meant to be married, let the mist disperse. So the mist settled, and that was the sign for them to get married. That's how the Chinese race began, you see. And Fu Xi was the one who was supposed to control the flow of the Yellow River, the Wanghe, And the Chinese civilization began around the delta of the Huanghe, the Yellow River. Huang means yellow, so Huanghe, the Yellow River. The river, the reason why it's called Yellow River is because of the soil carried down, which is yellow. See? And it is one of the big rivers. It's the river in the north. See? The three big rivers that flow from west to east, beginning from the mountains in the Himalayas, and then flows down, 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 and gathers momentum and flows faster and faster. So almost once every year there's flooding, and every few years there's a certain cycle. Every few years the flooding would be very bad. See? And the flooding resulted in the yellow soil called loess, we study in geography. It's being deposited on the land. And it becomes fertile. Then you plant paddy or whatever, the plants will grow well. But at the cost of so many lives, each time the river banks overflow, thousands or millions of lives can be taken. And in those early days when there was no flood mitigation efforts, technology was not so well developed, many people died. So through sorrow comes fertility and prosperity, you see. So, you know, that type of life that they live in, yeah. And this Fuxi was supposed to be the one who taught them how to tame the river, how to build dikes, and how to, you know, prevent the water from overflowing. And yet, on and off, it overflowed. So in the history of China, you discover that there were periods when just millions died, you see. Terrible disaster took place, okay. You can check up more. Nowadays, everything's on the internet, or almost everything. Some things are still not there. But you see, there are people who are well-versed in all this. They have published material, and this material has been translated. Or Westerners have gone to China, and their interest is in Chinese history and Chinese mythology. They studied all this. They translated this. And you can look at read more of this on the internet. But for our purpose, it's sufficient to just give you an appreciation or a bit of the background to this. But apart from the Fuxi Pakua, or known also as the Xian Tian, the earlier heaven Pakua, there is another way of arranging the trigrams. So the trigrams are made up of solid lines and broken lines, three arranged in different combinations. So when you put two sets of each with one another, you come to 64 combinations. See? The combinations rises very quickly. Beyond 64, it becomes too unwieldy and not practical anymore. And it is up to this stage that the arrangement stops. Then you have the eight trigram, you know, the eight-sided diagram. I intended to print it, but it turned out black. I don't know why. I had to check, you see. I wanted to print the Pakua diagram. And I believe many of you would have seen the Pakua. Next time you see your Chinese neighbor, look at the front of the house, hanging at the top of the house, maybe a Pakua sign with a mirror in the center. The mirror is to reflect away evil spirit. So if you, next time, if you are up in the attic, those of you who go to the attic, you look down the window, you see our neighbor, the one of the bedrooms has a Pakua hung up there with a mirror in the center, you see. Because their window opens to our side, it is as though they don't want bad chi to affect them from our side. If we are constantly opening and staring into them, it's bad chi. So they put that there so that we somehow psychologically feel, don't want to look there because of the Pakua. So to them, they explain it as reflecting away bad chi. But in fact, it is like when we see that, we don't want to look in that direction. So in fact, from here in the kitchen, you look up in the upstairs room, at the top there, you see the Pakua with a mirror there. Sometimes it's just a mirror to reflect away bad chi. But that particular Pakua, the arrangement of the trigram, is the whole Tian arrangement. It's different from the the sentient arrangement. And it is this that plays an important role in the culture of the Chinese. It began with the sentient pakua, started by Fu Xi, and he used it to explain things and taught the people, you know, how to predict events, so when certain combinations happen. So because he classified things and used all these pakua as labels to the events, so if certain combinations of events come together, then you know that there's a potential for a big flood occurring, for example. For example, you see the combination for the seasons, see? So what season is it? Then you have to see whether the crops are good or bad previously, see? Then you have to see also the weather conditions, such as you see whether it has been cold or hot. So to us, hearing this, you might say all this is again hocus pocus, superstition. But actually, there are scientific reasons behind it, behind all this. For example, if your recent crop is not good, see, why? See, because of the not sufficient rain. So the weather must be such that the rain has not fallen and is accumulating somewhere. When it comes, it's going to be very heavy. See, so if that season has been particularly hot and dry, then you expect perhaps a cold front of the wind to blow in after that. See, so by a combination of all these things, because of the labels and combinations, they are able to say, there's a likelihood of a severe flood occurring. See, because if the heavy rain were to fall and then the water will flow, and then before too long the flood will come. See? So it was used like that, and this the whole Tian Pakua was refined and rearranged. The trigrams, the kua, are rearranged, and then the combinations are used to predict when eclipse would occur, when the solar system would behave in a certain way, and in that way, the Chinese calendar was drawn up. And with time is refined, and up to today the pakua is used in that way, see? So the whole Tian pakua. So you say, is it hocus pocus? Along the way you find elements of hocus pocus coming in, especially when applied by the quack experts. They call themselves experts when in fact they're quacks. But this pakua and the theory behind it has been used to draw up the Chinese calendar, and it has been used for generations. See? And we know that it is an accurate calendar. So for example, if you want to see whether there's high tide in Port Dickson, say you want baptism to be held in the sea, for example, you don't consult the Western calendar, it doesn't tell you that. If you consult the Chinese calendar, then you can tell, see, or on the 15th of the month, when is the 15th? The 15th doesn't coincide exactly with the 15th of the Western calendar. The 15th of the Chinese lunar calendar might be 3 or 4 days later, you see. Then you will know when there is high tide, see. So the weather is early morning one time, early evening one time. Then you estimate if you want to get baptized around about 10 o'clock. So if the full moon is on the 15th and at around about 6 is going to be full tide, then at 10 o'clock maybe it is still quite high tide, which is about it's good time to get baptized. See, in the old days when we baptized in Port Dickson, that's what we did. We used the Chinese calendar to find out when is the high tide. See? So in that way, we by adjusting full high tide at what time, then after a few hours it will be still quite high, but water is receding, and then the cycle repeats. Then there's morning high tide, there's evening high tide. See, then you go out to get baptized at what time would be nice time. Otherwise you go at a time when it's low tide, you see, during the day. Then you wait the whole day, you see the water is still very far away. You will go so far, you see the water is just up to your knee. You can't baptize well, see. So there was once or twice we met with situation like this. We walk so far, and people, the rest just stay at the beach, and we are so far away. And even when we thought we have walked far enough. The depth was still not so good. For baptizing, we barely managed to immerse the person, you see. So that's why we consulted a Chinese calendar to see when is high tide and when is a good time to go for baptism. Yeah? So all in all, what we want to say is that the Pakua, the whole Tian Pakua, has been used in this manner to draw up the Chinese calendar. Then the combinations has been used to classify events and weather and the climate and the life of the Chinese, yeah? In such a way that the book has been written out the I Ching of the often translated a book of changes in English. It has been translated for academic purpose and not used, of course, it's just academic purpose. But for the Chinese, up to today, it's consulted. And of course, there is the proper, more scientific usage of the I Ching, but others use it to get tikam echo, you know, get numbers, you know, you're born, a baby just born in a house, so what month, what day, and then they consult the book and then get the number from there, then buy the lottery ticket based on this book of changes. So of course that is a hocus pocus way of using it. But to those who are knowledgeable, they use this book as a way to calculate and to estimate and to predict events, you see. And this does not mean that it's perfect. It does not mean that it will be exactly as it happens. Because sometimes those who are not so expert fail to take into consideration the changes. This was produced in temperate climates. Then you come to a tropical climate. The stars and the weather and the tides of the sea, they differ somewhat. You have to give allowance for all this, and they fail to give allowance. When they fail to give allowance, then it would not be so accurate in their calculation and predictions. See? But all in all, what we want to say is that there's something about it. It has been used for centuries. And if the Chinese calendar has been drawn up by the help of the Hou Tian Pakua, you can imagine this is not something that we just push aside as insignificant, that is just merely superstition. It's not. There's something about it. Although we must add that the people who are not expert in it, they just do some studies and mix with a fair amount of superstition in them, in their personality, you discover they abuse it, they claim, make big claims that don't turn out to be true. Okay? Now, all in all, we want to draw to a conclusion. Next week when we come to see the applications of it, you discover, hey, you know, you never thought of it that way. There's a way of applying some of these things that make sense. But on the other hand, there are certain things that are basically common sense in everyday life. We don't have to consult the expert. So I will tell you some of these stories later on, okay, when we come to the applications. So we draw to a close. We want to remember that the whole subject appears to be on human wisdom. And this is where our background reading of scripture comes in. We, as it were, began by reading the scriptures. And then from there we draw out the teaching of scripture. We saw that Solomon was a man of God. He was not a perfect man, but he was nevertheless blessed with wisdom from God. He was the wisest man in his time. See? So he made a study of things. And he was not enamored. He was not so taken away by these studies that he got so engrossed and forgot his responsibilities as an instrument of God in the nation. And we are therefore to see that we have a responsibility to study knowledge, gain knowledge with a view of being used by God in the world. We want to be good witnesses for God in the world. We want to be good helpers to those who have to face difficulties adjusting to the Christian life to the Chinese culture. So in order to be able to be of help, we have to study this. So in conclusion, we note these principles form the basis of traditional Chinese medicine and underlies the many styles of Chinese martial arts and the art of feng shui, which is used, which is referred to often in daily life. Then our study of Chinese philosophy is for the purpose of understanding the Chinese culture and how it influences Chinese behavior. We bear in mind the truth of sola scriptura. Scripture alone is our only authority in all matters of faith and practice. So while we explore and learn and try to appreciate how our non-believing Chinese friends think and how they behave, nevertheless bear in mind that our authority is scripture. We don't get drawn away so much to the point that we think that the human wisdom is on the same level or better than the Bible. Don't ever think like that. Always remember that God's word is our only authority in all matters of faith and practice. So with these thoughts, we come to the end of tonight's study. Are there questions or comments?